Football is back, and right now Bet365 are offering a wide range of markets, including first, last, and anytime goal scorers. With over 45 million members, it's the world's favourite online betting company. We've got wall-to-wall Premier League football with games being played nearly every day. And with Bet365 Bet Builder, you can combine match results, players to score, number of goals, and more to create your own personalised bet. And if you can't watch all the games live, with Bet365's Match Day feature, you can follow every moment through live graphics and text. Bet365 is the world's favourite online sport betting company. The app can be downloaded from Google Play and Apple App Store. Over 18s only. Please gamble responsibly.
Hi there, and welcome to a special bonus edition of the Ornstein and Chapman podcast from The Athletic. I'm Adam Leventhal, and today I'll be discussing the summer transfer window. Now, it was announced on Wednesday that it will open for 10 weeks between the 27th of July, that's the day after the end of the Premier League season, and the 5th of October. And over the course of this episode, we'll take an in-depth look at the impact of that decision. Why have English football's governing bodies decided to add an additional domestic window? And what impact will that have on the spending of your club, whether it's Manchester United or Southend United? I'm joined on the panel today by two of The Athletic's football news journalists, the man who's got his name above the door of this podcast, David Ornstein. David, great to have you with us.
Hi, Adam. How are you doing?
Very well indeed. We also have The Athletic's football news and investigations reporter, whose team I have already managed to crowbar into the intro. Matt Slater, did you appreciate the mention of the Mighty Shrimpers?
Yeah, thanks very much, Adam.
No problem. It's good to have them in the spotlight. We'll also have a look at the impact of COVID-19 on various clubs' spending power, both domestically and for the traditional big spenders across Europe. Do we expect a quieter window, or will certain clubs, perhaps Chelsea and Manchester City, with a financial model that is a little more COVID-proof, look to exploit this window and steal a march on their title rivals? All that and much more to come over the course of the next 30 minutes or so. This is the Ornstein and Chapman podcast, a summer transfer window special. And don't forget, right now you can enjoy The Athletic free for 30 days. So you can enjoy all of our great articles from the best football writers anywhere, plus a network of ad-free podcasts as well, by going to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman to sign up without paying a penny. Right, let's get to our guests, David and Matt. Let's get stuck in to the topic of the summer transfer window, because it has taken quite a bit of time to come to this decision. David, Matt, I'll leave it up to you. Who wants to kick off first on exactly how this decision was come about in the first place?
Yeah, Matt may have some more details than me on the actual logistics. From my perspective, it's a bit of FIFA, the authorities, setting the parameters during the COVID period on what was possible with transfer windows or not. I saw one document early on that was allowing flexibility for leagues and national associations to set their windows. Then there were a load of meetings for each league, so the Premier League holding their shareholders meetings and deciding what they wanted to do, how many weeks they wanted to use, whether they wanted to open before the end of the season, given that leagues like Germany, once the restart was announced, would be finishing before the Premier League, and so therefore opening their transfer window, and discussion over whether the Premier League should do it at the same time so they didn't lose a competitive advantage. But in recent weeks, it's very much come to a logical conclusion that this should be done once the season's over to maintain integrity and not distract teams who are fighting for promotion, relegation, Champions League places, Europa League places, etc. And it was always looking like being a 10-week window, whether it was going to be at the beginning of July until the beginning of September, end of July until the beginning of October. So that's how it's panned out. And what I was a bit surprised about is that they're bolted on a couple of weeks for a domestic trading period between the EFL and Premier League at the end of the transfer window. So it will close on, what, October the 5th, and then continue for 11 days or so. And so I think it was more a logical thing within the parameters that were set by the governing bodies. But Matt may know a lot more.
I'd agree with that. No, I think logical is the way to explain this. I mean, the thing about transfer windows is that everyone sums up, well, not everyone, but it's often forgotten that they are sort of very arbitrary creation, really. They're a sort of a kind of an agreement with the European Commission to give footballers the kind of rights and the kind of expectations that we take for granted. That you know, if you or I, Adam, wanted to go work for somebody else, and they were, you know, liked us as well, we could go if they offered us more money or a better job or less hours, whatever it might be that appeals to us. We can go now. Now football doesn't work like that, for good reason, for team buildings, for the integrity of the competition. But there has to be a kind of a happy medium, a compromise, and transfer windows is the compromise. And they have to be long enough to be meaningful, to give players a chance to find jobs and work and further their careers, but not too long to upset the competition. So there's always a bit of haggling about them. We have two, one's longer than the other. But, you know, FIFA does let each nation, each country pretty much decide what it wants to do. I mean, I remember when I've written about this in the past, one of the sort of great stats about transfer windows is there's a window open somewhere in the world every day of the year. It's just that we tend to focus, you know, for obvious reasons, because that's where the biggest, richest clubs are and most of the players are there, on Europe. So there's always a bit of the whole transfer window thing is a bit of a movable feast. Now, coronavirus has obviously thrown all that up in the air. You know, some leagues, France in particular, not bothering to restart. So it could effectively go with the usual summer, if you like, the usual summer window. And then, you know, most of the other big leagues, including the Premier League, playing on. So there was always going to have to be a new compromise to the compromise. And that's what we've got. And FIFA normally allows 12 weeks for this bigger one. I think it's 16 weeks in total you can do for your window. So, you know, 12 and 4. The Premier League, because it's going a little later than the others, have effectively gone for 10. And the crucial thing about the 10 is they are staying in line with what everyone else is, and they're also staying in line with what UEFA wants. UEFA were really, really keen that everyone shut their window on October 5th, because that is the deadline for registering your teams for the Champions League and Europa League. So we're all doing that. But then the sort of the further compromise to the compromise is that's not fair on EFL clubs. And EFL clubs, of course, have been upset in recent years that the Premier League kind of almost unilaterally decided to shut their window a little earlier because that's what some of the big managers, the big clubs in the Premier League wanted, thinking that the rest of Europe would do the same. And then the EFL followed suit because they were at that time trying to sort of ape everything the Premier League did to curry favour with the Premier League, and pointed out, well, hold on a minute, you've just hamstrung us for no reason. So there's a little bit of kind of, you know, working that out now. And they're giving EFL clubs effectively, was it 10 more days? It's till the October the 16th to do deals amongst themselves and with Premier League clubs. Premier League clubs can't do deals with each other during that period. So it is really just a sort of, you know, flowing that way down the pyramid, that extra period at the end.
Matt, a bit of a boring sort of operational question. Is the Premier League's window going to be classed as 10 weeks or 12 weeks? And if it's 10 weeks, is there any potential for them to take 6 weeks in January, or would it still be 4 and you'd just leave 2 in hand?
Well, I think that's a really good question, and I have tried to get an answer to that, and I haven't been able to get anyone to answer it yet. I do suspect with a lot of this, they're sort of kind of going from big decision to big decision, and sort of not making up as they go along, but sort of leaving some things unresolved. My gut feeling is that this will be basically a 12-week window. This will be the traditional summer window, because we're going to go into 2020-21. It's going to be a condensed season. There's going to be lots going on anyway. I think 4 weeks will be plenty. And I often think there's way too much whinging and moaning about the length of these windows anyway. I think that Italy are probably going to go with a pretty short window. They're not opening their window immediately after the end of their season. Pretty much every big league is keeping to what UEFA want with that October 5th finish. Germany's doing something slightly different in that they are, broadly speaking, going for a sort of a, you know, their 12 weeks from mid-July, because of course they finished. July 1st was a sort of open, they opened a little one-day window, basically just to register players that had already done deals, you know, had already had sort of done a kind of, you know, deals. So it was just a sort of registration day. And their window, I think, opens on July 15th.
Yeah, I think the Premier League did something similar, actually, to allow Chelsea to register Hakim Ziyech and Timo Werner, who have been able to start training, although I think Werner's been on holiday. Ziyech actually has been into Cobham, and then it shuts straight away. So a similar sort of mechanism.
We'll come on to how, you know, maybe Chelsea and Manchester City, as we mentioned a little bit earlier on, and some of the big guns in the Premier League may even spend more during the transfer window. But I wanted to come back to that extension, seeing as we may as well deal with it now. What impact do you think that is going to have on EFL clubs? Is this not going to be even more disruptive for them, because they are simply going to hang on longer into the season to find out what, for want of a better phrase, sort of offcuts they are going to be thrown from Premier League clubs? Or do you envisage it's going to be, you know, lower league clubs wanting to buy Premier League players as well? Or how do you think that's going to manifest itself, Matt?
There's a crucial word in that question. You said buy. I don't know how much buying is going to be going on, to be honest. We're talking loans, aren't we, really? I mean, again, I go back to that point that I think we tend to sort of, do they have enough time? They've got time. EFL clubs are already doing deals. I mean, this week's actually been, there've been some quite significant ones. Bolton are throwing money around in League Two. You know, they've just gone down and, you know, they're out signing. They've got Swindon's best player, Owen Doyle, from last season, the man that fired them to, you know, up the table to promotion, and they've just gone out and got Plymouth's best player, another promoted player. So it's happening. I noticed Coventry signed someone yesterday from Villa. Is it Callum O'Hare? So the clubs that have money, the clubs that are you know, looking at their finances and thinking, right, okay, we can do some business, are doing it right now. You're right in that, you know, that the EFL season is very likely to start either right at the end of August or the first weekend of September. It's going to start, you know, at least a week to 2 weeks before the Premier League starts. But that's not unusual. I think most EFL clubs will not be upset about when the transfer window finishes and when's the last moment they can do business. They will be thinking, when can I get fans in? When do I have to start behaving like a football club again? If all those clubs that have just been watching the playoffs will be thinking, right, I've got like 8 players. I've got to suddenly ramp up to 2023, 25, whatever it might be, whatever we can afford. And I've got to start arranging pre-season and friendlies. And are we going to do those? Are we going to have to, you know, start to think about their own testing regimes and cleaning regimes and travel regimes? Those are the things that when I talk to EFL clubs, that's what they're talking about. Because for most of them, they've just pulled the shutters down for 3-4 months now and haven't had to be football clubs, really. That's going to change. So that's the thing I hear from the EFL.
The common feeling within the game is that extra 2 weeks will, as Matt points out, allow Premier League clubs to send young or players who are surplus to requirements on loan to EFL clubs, and the EFL clubs will lap them up. It was quite interesting that the priority during really the height of the pandemic, when these negotiations were starting to ramp up on the transfer window, the priority of EFL clubs was to get money flowing through the system and to be able to trade their way out of financial oblivion, really. And so even if it does disrupt the season, and I'd be very interested on Matt's view on this, they actually wanted the EFL to continue trading until March. That was their initial preference, for the transfer window to just stay open, because for many, this is being seen for the next year is probably about securing their existence and survival rather than prioritising football. It's the finances that are so key, and they need the money to be flowing through the game.
Well, that is really interesting. I did hear something along those lines. I mean, I think we could sort of kind of, you know, haggle and argue about, is it March? Is it February? Is it, you know, the principle was interesting though, wasn't it? You know, a much longer window, because let's be honest, pretty much all EFL clubs, well, half the Premier League as well, are selling clubs, right? And player trading is absolutely essential. So of course, in this remarkable period that we're going to go through, and we're going to, you know, be talking about it for another year, 18 months, the financial impact is going to be hard, on particularly further down the pyramids, that you want to make, you want to give these clubs, you know, every tool, every possible weapon that, that they have. I think it does come back to my very first answer though about it. Transfer windows are always this compromise between giving clubs the ability to trade, giving players the ability to further their careers and move, and the integrity of the competitions. And the kind of things that managers talk about, it always makes me laugh whenever we have a sort of discussion about transfer window, even in a normal season, you'll get half a dozen managers saying, oh, I can't believe it. They've ruined the first 2 weeks of the season. I've got my centre forward, he wants to leave, and you know, totally ruined my pre-season. And then it'll go the other way the next season. And it's sort of like, well, you know, the Germans and the Spanish have got a massive advantage over us. What have we done? Why have we gifted them that huge advantage? What are we thinking? Why do we always do this? Well, you know, come on, you can't please these people sometimes. And I know that's a sort of very Premier League point of view, but it does affect League One, Championship, League Two, all the way down as well. You know, the managers, if they have a good group, they like their group. If they're not happy with their group, they want to trade. So there's a little bit of human nature at play here as well.
Let's talk maybe in general terms, and if you want to sort of stick some specific examples in there, then that would be great. But in terms of the spending, let's start at the top level. We know that, you know, Manchester City are in a good place right now because they know that they're going to be playing in the Champions League. I know that Sam Lee has written recently about specific targets that or areas of the pitch that they want to strengthen in. Do you envisage any of the big clubs are going to be hindered at all in the amount of money that they will spend due to COVID-19, just simply due to the financial backing that they have, in particular Manchester City and Chelsea, who we've also seen have flexed their muscles already, David?
We can only go on what the clubs are telling us, and that could be interpreted how you wish, because they might want to be protecting their financial strength. They might want to be very careful with the optics of talking about spending in a global sort of health and financial crisis. And there are some realities that we've got to accept, whether many football fans like it or not. You know, the likes of Manchester United and City, it's hard to describe it as losing millions every week, but their revenues are reduced by millions every week, and that definitely affects the amount that they either can or are willing to spend in this upcoming transfer window. Then on the flip side, which Matt can explain a bit more, there's the relaxation of financial fair play rules, which has got a lot of fans excited. I don't know how that's going to manifest itself in the market and whether we'll see a massive uplift on what clubs were planning already. And as such, Manchester City's plans, as Sam has written about, haven't really changed as a result of their Champions League ban being lifted, because they were confident throughout and they kind of knew what finances they'd have to play with throughout. And therefore, they are going to attack this market. What Sam is explaining is that since the ban is lifted, they're probably just going to attack it with even more strength and determination to put themselves back up at the top of the game. Well, in the Premier League, at least, because they might finish this season at the top of Europe with their Champions League campaign ongoing and FA Cup as well. So, yeah, they've got plans at centre half. They've got a number of options. There's interest, as we've reported, in Kalidou Koulibaly, and some versatility with Nathan Ake also among their options from Bournemouth. Lots will depend, and I'll speak about this in a minute, on what happens with the status of clubs like Bournemouth, the end of the season for clubs like Manchester City, what they can and want to do. Left back is an area, and we talked about that on the last podcast, that Manchester City are looking to strengthen in as well. well with a couple of targets and a willingness to let players go, a replacement for Leroy Sané at left wing. So all sorts of possibilities there. There's going to be issues for many clubs on shifting existing players out, and that will affect what they're able to do with incomings. Manchester United, they've been very careful to explain about how the mentality around transfers needs to shift this summer, because it's not going to be all that we or many of us think or want it to be. But then on the flip side, there's that strong interest in Jadon Sancho. And if Manchester United qualify for the Champions League, it seems very clear that they'll make a strong attempt to close that deal out. But Borussia Dortmund are not going to budge on their asking price, at least not much. So that one is going to be really one to watch, because we know the right side is United's priority, and that Jadon Sancho is the first choice for that position. And there will be other positions that we've spoken about with Laurie Whitwell on this podcast that United are thinking about recruiting in as well. Liverpool are the ones really who seem to be most conscious of how the pandemic is going to affect their spending. They didn't close out a deal for Timo Werner, as we know, and he ended up going to Chelsea. They've been very clear in explaining how much money they're losing and how that's going to affect their plans in the transfer market. They've been linked with Thiago Alcantara of Bayern Munich, and the suggestions are that they don't want to go to the asking price that Bayern want for him. Chelsea, yeah, Roman Abramovich, you know, our Chelsea reporters have written in depth about how he could see this as a massive opportunity to spend like he hasn't for some years and to lead Chelsea back to the top. They've brought in Hakim Ziyech, Timo Werner, they've been linked with Kai Havertz. There's a lack of satisfaction around the performance of Kepa in goal, and we've written about their interest in Andre Onana of Ajax. It's a long way round of explaining that plans haven't changed massively for those clubs right at the top. When you come down a little below to the likes of Tottenham and Arsenal, much bigger questions are going to be asked. Tottenham have taken out a £175 million Bank of England loan to help them through the crisis. That is not available for transfers, so they're going to be spending quite little, I would imagine, and looking for some creative solutions in terms of swaps and loans. Maybe similar with Arsenal, they have restructured their debt. The Kroenke family have restructured their debt, and that could allow them a bit more flexibility, but that will mainly be around day-to-day operations during this crisis. Their players have taken a pay cut, and that's the final point I'll make on this before handing over to Matt. How can clubs like Arsenal and Liverpool, and this is the point they're making more than me, explain to their players, you know, we're going to go and spend 40, 50, 60 million on this player, that player, and the other player. And yes, they're paid in installments, but cumulatively, there could be significant outlay if they really went for the targets that they want, when they've asked their players during this pandemic to take pay cuts and deferrals. So there's a little bit of internal politics around this sort of thing as well.
Yeah, Matt, how does that break down in terms of the balance sheet? How will the powers at these various clubs that are having to make those decisions, that there is money going one way, but it's not going into the pockets of the players that are already at the club, how is that actually balanced out by the football clubs?
I mean, broadly speaking, we're talking about a transfer window, going into a window where pretty much every club is down about a quarter to a third, you know, in terms of their sort of projections. And there's still a lot of uncertainty there, and clubs hate uncertainty. You know, we're still kind of trying to hammer out, you know, how the rebate is going to work going forward, when fans can come back, how many fans can come back, can you sell them food and drink, will fans want to come back in big numbers, how much money we're all going to have in our pockets. Are we all going to be buying two shirts this season, or one, or none? Will we keep up with our Sky Sports subscriptions or whatever else? There's a lot of uncertainty around club finance, and that of course is going to play out in the transfer window. I think the Man City example is they are almost a sort of a bit of an exception in so many ways. I mean, they were staring down the barrel of a 200 million or so loss over the coming two seasons, because for most of the big clubs, a good run in the Champions League is worth about 100 million quid these days. If you include most of that would be, you know, the prize money, the TV money direct from UEFA. You then get your match day revenue and you get all your uplifts from your sponsorships. Now that problem's gone away. So they are coming into this window in a sort of slightly different frame of mind perhaps than the others. And then I think the other thing that kind of flows over all of this, And it does tie in with the point David made about the relaxation of financial fair play, of UEFA's financial fair play rules, which I'll explain just in a minute. But the thing, the kind of overriding idea is, okay, it's a crisis. And it's that old cliche, you know, a crisis can be an opportunity though. If everybody is hurting a little bit and everyone's values are down, everyone needs money, do I be brave now? Is now the time actually to speculate? I saw quite an interesting report from the Swiss bank, USB, the other day, saying that the wealthiest people, the very, very wealthiest people, have actually done pretty well already out of the crisis, because they're the ones that have enough money to not panic. They have enough money to pick up the bargain that is going to be available. And that could be anything from taking, you know, an investment, you know, buying something, spending a little bit more money on what you're doing. And that all of this will apply to football clubs too. So yes, it's a depressed football economy, but some clubs are feeling a little bit more upbeat than others. And they're all probably wondering, do you know what though? This might not be a bad time to sort of sort out that right-wing issue that we've known we've had, or that kind of second centre-back problem, or to invest a little bit more at this age group because we always knew we had to do it, and maybe now is the time to do it because everybody else is hurting. So there's so many bits to it. How the clubs communicate that to their players, this is where they're going to earn their corn, isn't it? Because we just have had this sort of 2-3 month conversation about belt tightening and we're all in it together and football's got to do its bit. You know, you or I, again, to go back to that kind of making it personal analogy, wouldn't like it if we'd been sort of sent messages about, guys, you know, the company's going through tough times and we've all got to pitch in, da, 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 da. And then you find out, oh, right, thanks, you've just signed my replacement. Thanks very much. You know, and that's, you know, this is, we're talking about human beings. So I think it's going to be a really interesting transfer window, actually, because so many different moving parts to it.
One club who were in wage deferral cut talks with their players, and then the players came forward and said, but you know, there's reports that we're interested in signing someone for 20 million. And the message that came back to them from the club was that, no, that's a different pot of money. And that was just as confusing, because surely money is money. So there are some tough conversations that need to take place. And it'd be really interesting to see if clubs with a bit of financial resource sort of prey on those who need to get rid of players and start sweeping up young players from the EFL or from more financially troubled clubs like a Wigan Athletic, selling off some of their best young players at this sort of time. And that would allow not only the very biggest Premier League clubs, but those far further down the table who can afford those smaller amounts to kind of minesweep and take advantage of that. And one other problem that sort of relates to what Matt said about how you're going to explain this to your players: many of those players are on really strong contracts. Just before we started recording, I saw a list of Arsenal's centre-half options. You know, they've got sort of 7 or 8 on their books. They've just loaned Mavropanos out, but they've signed him to a new contract to protect his value, which is pretty shrewd. But they've got a stable of centre-halves, many of whom are on long and strong contracts. They might well not want to leave during a financial crisis when they've got financial security there. And meanwhile, all we hear in reports is that they want to bring in 1 or 2 centre-halves. Well, that will take you to 10. So there are going to be real issues with clubs shifting players that they don't want during this market, I think.
And I just remember, sorry, I promised to explain the financial fair play relaxation point because it is interesting. Again, it comes back to this sort of, is this actually now quite a good time to spend? Idea, because what they've actually done is effectively they've taken the usual 1 year accounting period where you have to sort of balance your books, blah blah blah, within certain caveats and, you know, allowable losses. They've turned it into a 2-year one. Now, a shrewd club, a club with cash, might be thinking, well, you know, we could spend big now at a time when values are all 10, 15, 20%, depends who you talk to, you know, off. There's a sale on. So if you've got that cash, if you've got that ability to move now, while as I say, you know, the sales are on, go for it if you can. That'll be the thought process.
Hello, I'm James Richardson, host of the Totally Football Show, now part of the Athletics Podcast Network. We're going to be here following all the action as the 2020 football season reaches its belated conclusion. And if you're an Athletics subscriber, you can now hear exclusive ad-free versions of our show on the Athletic app And don't worry, if you're not a subscriber, you can still listen to us for free with the occasional word from our sponsor by searching for The Totally Football Show on Apple, Spotify and all the usual podcast places. The Totally Football Show with me, James Richardson, still totally free and now totally ad-free on The Athletic.
Let's throw the net out a bit wider. I mean, we've spoken about English clubs in the Premier League spending. In terms of the European clubs that you're aware of and you have connections with, obviously we know about Real Madrid and Barcelona over the years. They will cherry pick the prized asset at some, you know, English clubs. Eden Hazard's a good example. Are we expecting that to still be the case, that top Premier League clubs will still have to worry about the big La Liga clubs coming in for their big guns as well? Or is it going to be a one-way street this time around?
That's going to be fascinating because they are really feeling the pinch financially. And it's not just due to this crisis, but they were already starting to tighten up the purse strings over the last few years. If you look at Real Madrid, they've not really been, you know, they did, of course, sign Eden Hazard, but they've not been signing at the rate they were doing before the Galactico sort of years. And they've been picking up some more affordable options from Brazil, young players, and sort of trying to secure their future in a way that they weren't doing in times gone by. Barcelona, anybody you speak to in European football says that they are on the verge of financial disaster and bankruptcy, and it's unbelievable that they're being linked with all these players, but that they always find a way to make these deals happen by trading some swaps and money is found from somewhere. And I think they've got some real problems that they need to sort out before they can be an enormous player in the market like they have been in recent years. That said, that these clubs are in conversations. I speak to people that, you know, Real Madrid, for example, they are in the conversation over someone like Jadon Sancho. That just doesn't mean that they're going to sign him this summer. Similar, I'm sure, with the likes of Kylian Mbappe and any top player out there, because there is that dream for many players of playing for Real Madrid and an expectation at Real Madrid that they will re-enter the market at some point, surely, in a way that we've come to know of them. You've got like a Borussia Dortmund who continue to sign some of the best young players in the world. We saw Haaland in January. We're seeing Jude Bellingham now. They may be able to finance even more by agreeing a deal with Manchester United for Jadon Sancho. I don't know this for 100%, but I've heard suggestions that during the crisis, they took out quite a significant bank loan. And if that's the case, then the finances are going to be a key consideration for them. Similar for Bayern Munich. Inter Milan seem to be recruiting in recent years like there's no tomorrow. And they're being linked again, possibly with Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. By no means saying that he's going there. He may well sign a new contract at Arsenal. We'll see what happens on that. But it just shows that even the Italian clubs are in the mix. AC Milan, less so. But Juventus, you know, they've done a very creative swap deal involving Arthur and Pjanic. I've heard Juventus have been involved in conversations about certain other, you know, high-profile signings. And the message that's come back is that the money's just not there this summer, even for a Juventus. So I think the Premier League can probably rest easier than they have in times gone by over European vultures circling for their top players. They will be in the conversations. But if you look at Real Madrid with what we just said about the young players and Dortmund with Bellingham, I wonder if those continental clubs are now actually looking at the next generation and then, you know, recognizing that they can sell them back to the Premier League for huge profit than necessarily going in for Galactico signings at this point in time.
One final point I wanted to talk to you both about, and I would recommend that, obviously, if you are listening to this and you're thinking, right, I want to hear about my club, I'm a Southampton fan, or I'm a Watford fan, or I'm a West Ham fan, I want to hear what they are going to be doing in this transfer window. They will all be discussed, I'm sure, in the club-specific podcasts that are available ad-free on The Athletic. So do look out for those. But just in general terms, the five sub rule, which has now been confirmed, and that's going to be rolled out for next season. A lot of the critics are saying that this simply favours the big clubs because they can have far greater strength weighting, and it can be game-changing, especially in the second half of games, and they'll be more determined to keep hold of their big players, and they might even be able to bring in more big players and say, well, no, you will get some time because we can have more substitutes and things like that. What impact do you think it is going to have in terms of the business that clubs do in terms of incomings, but also keeping hold of their talent. And I suppose this goes on to the point of the EFL clubs saying, well, can we not have, for example, with Watford, for example, Nathaniel Shalabar or Domingos Quina, could we not have him on loan, or could we not take them? Well, Watford may well say, well, no, we're going to keep hold of him because we need a strong bench. So what impact do you think it's going to have on clubs? Because it's a very difficult one to pick, isn't it?
It is. And I can't wait to see how it's going to play out, I think is my answer, because I'm hearing the same things. I heard quite a good idea the other day. Some EFL clubs wondering if maybe your fourth and fifth sub had to be a young player, had to be a homegrown player. You know, that kind of sort of ties in with the whole kind of EFL strategy around bringing players through, being a kind of sort of a finishing school for young talent. I think that's an interesting idea. I'm not sure it's going to come off. And look, we should probably point out that we don't know if the Premier League or even the EFL are going to say, yeah, we want this particular rule. I understand that UEFA are already thinking for their own competitions, perhaps not. It was always there in the original FIFA suggestion, the sort of original set of ideas FIFA had when the pandemic struck, which involved sort of kind of, clearing space and tweaking some of their rules. One of them was, okay, look, anyone trying to finish this season in will be doing so in a congested period of time. We've got to think about player welfare. And FIFPro, the players union, have always been very supportive of this idea. And that, whilst some clubs, it tended to be the clubs towards the bottom of the Premier League, were upset around it, it did go through in terms of five subs for the end of this season pretty easily. I think, was it four or five clubs? I think it was four clubs voted against in the end. But we all just, it's really interesting, isn't it, how whenever there's a sort of change like this, we kind of get used to it really, really quickly. I think the reason people got surprised about it for next season is they sort of forgot that it had already been, that it was always there as a suggestion. And the rationale, of course, is that next season is going to be congested as well. It doesn't feel like it's going to be as congested, but we're not in it yet, are we? So we don't really know. There's still a lot of international football to fit in, and all the other competitions will be going on. And that's the reason why FIFA and IFAB, who look after the laws, have done it and have given everybody the right to continue it. I don't know how it's going to play out in terms of, I can see both ways, to be honest. Well, can't see both ways. I can see it almost having sort of no impact, and I can see it having an impact for the reasons that you outline in your question. Does this enable managers and teams and clubs to say, look, guys, we need to sort of hold this group together, and yes, you're going to get more playing time, and yes, we can be, we can sort of, rotate the squad better. Or just it becomes, well, a lot of them have had big squads anyway, and they've just had surplus talent anyway, and we just won't really notice. I think it remains to be seen.
And I'll just finish with a quick point back on the transfer window. Before we recorded this, I spoke to a few people involved in the transfer markets as to what we can expect immediately. Now that we've got the dates confirmed, is this going to explode into life? And the message was very much no, because a pretty obvious point. It's so important to know where teams are going to finish this season, whether they're going to be relegated or promoted, whether they're going to be in the Europa League, the Champions League, etc. That's of critical importance for budgets, ever more so now in this environment. And they are so focused on these final few games of the season that everything is pretty much on hold. Yes, they have their plans. Yes, conversations have taken place. But until they know the outcome, until they know the budgets that they've got to play with, they're not really moving. But then even when the season finishes, that is the only window for these players to go on holiday for 1 or 2 weeks, even if it's not abroad. They want to get themselves out of the loop. And yeah, they had a long break, an extraordinarily long break during the crisis, but they weren't able to get away. They weren't able to switch off mentally. And somebody explained to me it's going to be the quietest period of all straight after the season finishes, and then it will start to ramp up as we get into August, September. It's a really long window, as Matt's explained at the start. It's going to be, 12 weeks at a time that we're not used to seeing trading in September and into October. So I do think we just have to have a little bit of calm, and yeah, there will be an absolute flurry of activity in time, but I don't think it's going to be immediately as many people would expect.
We shall see. I bet we cut to shots of July the 27th, and there'll be new shirts being held aloft by new signings. Who knows?
Another point to mention on that is there's not going to be any time for pre-season tours, and of course with certain travel restrictions, that's going to be hard because the players are going to have a week or two maximum off. Some players will still be in European competition, and then they need to get back in pre-season training and friendlies for the new season. So a very unusual period ahead.
It is going to be very unusual, but it is going to be fascinating as well. David, Matt, thank you very much for being on the show. This has been, of course, a special summer transfer window edition of the Ornstein and Chapman podcast. David will be back on Tuesday with his regular podcast. And don't forget, right now, you can enjoy The Athletic free for 30 days by going to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. And just a reminder as well, as I mentioned before, do check out our club-specific podcasts for all the gossip and also the hopes and dreams for your clubs heading into that transfer window. Thank you for being with us, and we'll catch you soon.